again.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime gal. Send me a kiss, my wire. Baby, my heart's on fire. If you refuse me, honey, you lose me. Then you'll be left
in space. No one can hear you podcast, but we're going to try anyway. Welcome to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. I'm Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who will be revealed to be an android halfway through this recording.
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
You know, for an android, I feel pretty good.
That's good.
I have lots of emotions about things.
Yeah. Traditionally, androids feel pretty bad, so for an android...
Yeah, I'm doing all right, I guess.
Yeah, so if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and it's been a few weeks since we've recorded last, so we have a shitload of things.
Yeah, strap in.
Yeah, we have a potentially very long episode ahead of us, but that's cool, because we like to talk about things, and that's why we have a podcast, Mike.
Is that why we do this?
That's why we do this.
Oh, okay. I didn't get the memo.
Yeah, our mission statement was not 100% clear, but now we know. And then after all that, we're going to move on to our featured review. This week, it is the newest film from director Ridley Scott, the sequel to Prometheus and the sixth overall film in the Alien series, if you don't count the ones where they fight predators. It's Alien Covenant. Are you excited, Mike?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot to talk about for this movie.
Absolutely, yeah. We're both big fans of the Alien franchise, so it's always cool that there's a new Alien movie out. And it's even cooler that, you know, I was thinking about this this past weekend. I got to see a new Alien movie from Ridley Scott and new Twin Peaks episodes from David Lynch in the same weekend. And I was like, what is happening?
What year is it, Mike?
It is either 1979 or 1991, and I don't care which one it is. But yeah, so very excited to talk about Alien Covenant. Before we get into all of that, let's get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for... It's time for...
Film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news. Film news.
All right, it's time to get into some film news, Mike. And like we said before, it's been about 3 weeks since we recorded our last episode, so there is a lot of stuff to get through. And some of the biggest news that came out this past week. Recently, we reported that Sony is planning a solo Venom movie, a spinoff of their Spider-Man universe. And now they have an actor to play Venom, and they have a director, too. Tom Hardy is playing Venom in this solo Venom movie, Mike. How nuts is that?
Yeah, that's fucking insane. What a sentence that you just said.
This is a movie, when we talked about this, I think it was in our last episode, actually. It was either the last episode or the episode before it. When we talked about it, when they announced this thing, I was like, there's no way this happens.
Yeah, there's not a chance.
I will eat my hat before a Venom movie happens by 2018. And I still don't think it can make that date. It's aiming for October 2018, and it can make that date if it starts very, very soon.
Right now.
And I think that is the plan. But even so, I feel like it's a very, very slim window of time. That's like a little over a year, right? That's like 13 months or whatever, like 13, 14 months from now, between now and October 2018.
Something like that.
Something like that. I don't know math so well, kids.
How does math happen? I did read a conspiracy on Reddit, I believe, that I think is pretty fun to just imagine is true, that this is a hostage situation between Sony and Marvel, where they are casting a lead and hiring a director in an effort to get Marvel to buy the rights to Venom back also. Like, make them think they're going to make the movie then have Marvel...
I don't think
doesn't really make sense, but I'm going to pretend it's real.
That doesn't
make
sense. I mean, I think Marvel didn't buy the rights back to Spider-Man, though. Like, Sony's like sharing the character with them.
Right. Well, just to include Venom in that, I think, is what they meant.
Yeah. I don't think Marvel gives a shit about what what any of that does. Because, I mean, they don't officially have Spider-Man in a solo capacity. They're helping out Sony's solo Spider-Man movies and basically making the movie for them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
As far as Marvel's concerned, all they get out of this deal is that they can use Spider-Man in their movies. You know, that's right. They can throw him in the Avengers, and it's a cool thing. And it's really honest. Like, Sony is benefiting so much from this deal, and and Marvel is getting comparatively very little out of it, I think.
Yeah,
you know, Marvel has to make an extra movie.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess they're sharing the rights, right? So in theory, we were talking about Venom, how you make that movie without Spider-Man, but if Sony also has the rights to it, they could include Spider-Man.
They could.
It's just not...
Whatever. I guess it's like a gentleman's agreement as of right now.
Right.
I really think the Spider-Man connection to the Marvel Universe is very tenuous at best right now. There was talk about, one of the Sony executives was saying, once the contract is up that with Tom Holland, after a Spider-Man Homecoming 2 or whatever, they might, renegotiate and be like, oh, we don't want to be in the Marvel Universe anymore. And it's like, why would you even say that now, first of all? And also, why would you not want to be part of that thing?
Yeah, you're going to make a bajillion dollars. What are you doing?
Yeah, it's the most successful franchise going on in movies right now, pretty much, except with the possible exception of Fast and the Furious.
Sorry, that was just not where I thought that was going to go.
Well, it's true.
It is true, but who's ever thought of that before?
The only difference is that Marvel comes out with three times as many movies a year.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I'm getting a little off track there. This Venom movie is going to be directed by Ruben Fleischer, who was the director of Zombieland, which is a movie that I really liked. He also directed 30 Minutes or Less, which is a movie that I think is okay. And then he directed Gangster Squad, which is a movie that I think is terrible.
The Neil Blomkamp. Oh man, I can't talk. You know what I'm trying to say.
The Chappy guy.
I see he's following the Chappy arc.
Yeah, the arc of the Chappy. It's it's exactly the Neil Blomkamp thing. He made a really great debut, a really underwhelming second film, and then more underwhelming third film. And to be fair, I feel like when we watched Chappie, we kind of came out saying oh, it was all right.
I think we really liked it. Well, not really liked it, but I think we liked it when we did the episode.
Yeah, I think we did. And that was back in episode 4 or 5 of this podcast. You can go back and listen to it to hear how wrong we probably were about Chappie. I think we just really wanted it to be good. And I think there is some fun to be had with Chappie. It's a ridiculous movie, but we're going to go off topic again. This episode's going to be 3 hours long.
So for you listening at home, we normally recorded at 2 in the afternoon, but time schedules have shifted, life happens.
Right.
So we're recording at 7:30 at night. So we're somehow loopy as fuck right now. So this is fun.
Exactly. We each had long days of work. We're just fucking around now. Anyway, so what were we saying? Tom Hardy is Venom now, which I think... Which I think is great casting. I think it's a phenomenal choice for the role. I will say, if they wanted to do the hashtag bring back Topher, wouldn't say no. But
yeah, why not at this point?
But Tom Hardy's great casting choice for Venom, and he's a guy who I think picks his projects really carefully. He's generally in good stuff. I feel like Tom Hardy is, and he's done his share of bad stuff too. But it's always interesting bad stuff. I remember he was cast in Suicide Squad. If you remember, he was
right.
I think he was going to play Rick Flagg in that movie, and he dropped out. He left. Rick Flagg was Joel Kinnaman's character in Suicide Squad. If you needed a reminder, I saw your eyes light up. Who is that again?
I thought it was Captain Boomerang guy. Is that the same dude?
It was Jai Courtney. Maybe it was Captain.
I think
Boomerang.
That's I who know. Tom Hardy was supposed to be.
Maybe I thought he was Rick Flagg, but maybe I'm mistaken. But anyway, I think Tom Hardy saw that movie for what it was and was like, nope, I'm out.
I'm out. See you later.
I'm out. I'm going to go make Mad Max. And that was the best choice he possibly could have made. I think Tom Hardy as Venom is a really cool casting choice and probably bodes well for this movie. Ruben Fleischer directing, he did make Zombieland, which is a movie that I like a lot. And I think it's a very well-directed, very stylish movie. So, it could... There could be something there with Ruben Fleischer. I am eager to see what's happening there. And then also want to throw this out there, the Silver Sable Black Cat movie, which Sony's also making, which we talked about in the last episode, I think, as well. The Silver Sable and Black Cat are two other side Spider-Man characters who are getting their own movie now, apparently. And this now has a director. The director is Gina Price Brythewood, who directed a movie called The Secret Life of Bees a little while ago. She's mostly done indie films up until this point. But I think what's significant about this is that this would be the first African-American woman to direct a superhero movie, which is pretty nuts. So that's cool. They're very good on them for Sony. And again, I don't know. I know it has a director now. The Silver Sable Black Cat movie is not something I ever see hitting theaters at any point. I just feel like those characters are so obscure to mainstream audiences, and Sony does not have that Marvel marketing power to make that a known thing.
right
before that movie hits. So I don't know if that will happen, but I hope it does, just for the sake of diversity and all that stuff. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, why not? As long as they're making cool movies, like, go ahead.
Hopefully these movies are good. That's all we can say.
Exactly.
Anyway, that's the thesis for the last 10 minutes of this.
All right, 45 minutes in, we're through one piece of film news.
So let's get to the next thing. The Uncharted movie, which we've talked about in the past. We're both big fans of the Uncharted games. This Uncharted movie has been in the works for so long, Mike. I feel like... I think it's been since around like Uncharted 2, the video game came out in 2009.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember around then they were talking about like, David O. Russell being involved. Like he was attached to direct this thing with like Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci, and it was like, what is even happening? Mark Wahlberg was going to play Nathan Drake, and it's like, well, this is not going to be an Uncharted movie. It might be a cool movie, but it won't be Uncharted.
Right.
But then, you know, there's been so many different like changes in the director and changes in the screenwriters, and so recently it was announced that they cast Nathan Drake. They finally cast Nathan Drake. And it is not one that anybody expected. It's Tom Holland, who's playing Spider-Man. who is like 19 years old, something like that, right? He's a kid. He's Spider-Man.
20-something, I think, yeah.
He's very young. And apparently this Uncharted movie is being reworked again so that it's a prequel that takes place before the games. So I guess in this realm, the games are still going to be considered canon, and it's going to be taking place like years before, it's like kid Drake. I think it's gonna it's gonna take its cues from the flashbacks of like Uncharted 3 and Uncharted 4, where you see like kid Drake. I think it's gonna be like him meeting up with Sully and all that stuff. So we've already seen some of that stuff in the games, but I think there is like room for kind of like crazy adventures. You know, they always like allude to like, oh, remember this time we did that or whatever. And
right, yeah, I think one of the things we always talked about too when we talk about an Uncharted movie is that the games are so cinematic that an Uncharted movie of that story, like of one of the games, is just the game, right?
Yes.
So I think that is a smart idea as far as, you know, the Uncharted franchise and a movie would go, to set it in a, you know, not just remake one of the games, I guess.
Right.
To use a different story, set it in a different time period. I like that idea. I think young Nathan Drake is a really cool... Like, those flashback sequences in Uncharted 4 are fun and really interesting for his character. Like, you know, to show where he comes from and stuff. So why not? If I could make Tom Holland the next biggest actor at this point. He's gonna be. Like, go ahead.
He's Spider-Man now. I mean, it's nuts. I mean, what's great about him being Spider-Man is that he already has experience going like, whoa, 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 whoa.
And just falling and swinging everywhere.
Yeah, which will be half of Nathan Drake's actions in the movie, I'm sure.
And just sarcastic one-liners. Yeah, he's got it. He's got it down.
He's already got it. So there's that. But what is disconcerting to me about this is that Joe Carnahan was writing the script for Uncharted. And Joe Carnahan, a guy who I really love, you know, he's directed The Gray, and he directed Stretch and Narc and a whole bunch of cool stuff. And he was writing the script for this movie. He wasn't directing, but he was writing it. And that script has been thrown out now, which is kind of unfortunate.
But no.
In any case, Sean Levy is still attached to direct, who directed the Night at the Museum movies. He directed Real Steel, and you know he's a very like solid workmanlike director. I don't dislike Sean Levy. I don't particularly love any of his movies, but I don't.
He'll make a nice family adventure movie.
Yeah, I am hopeful for the Uncharted movie if it ever happens. Because again, it's been like 10 years in the making at this point.
Yeah, it'll be a double feature with the Silver.
With the Black Cat movie.
Yeah. Whose names you said 5 minutes ago, and I already forgot them.
So Sony really has its work cut out for them there.
Yeah, it's going to be hard.
I do have the next thing. Tom Cruise, Mike, the star of The Mummy itself, is...
you take that back.
The only Mummy movie ever made, star Tom Cruise, says that Top Gun 2 is apparently happening.
Sure. Why not? We got to remake every 80s movie ever. So
it's all happening. It's nostalgia, man. I mean, I think what's weird about this is that Top Gun 2 was kind of in the works for a while ago. I think this was also back in like 2010. Tom Cruise was talking about doing a Top Gun 2, and Tony Scott, who directed the original Top Gun, was set to direct Top Gun 2, and then he died, I think, in 2010 is when that happened. And so Top Gun 2 was kind of put on the back burner. For a long time, and I just haven't heard anything about it for a really long time. I remember it was a couple years ago they re-released Top Gun in 3D.
That sounds familiar.
I'm pretty sure that happened. There was a period of time where they were just re-releasing all the movies in 3D. But they did that. I'm pretty sure they did Top Gun at some point, and so that might have been like a litmus test for how people might have been excited for like how the appetite for Top Gun might be in the world. Like, who knows?
Right.
Anyway, so Tom Cruise is saying it's happening. Val Kilmer is saying he would like to come back as Iceman. So that would be something.
Sure. I mean, why not at this point?
Yeah, like, what else is Val Kilmer up to, you know? Like, why why not?
Savage.
Not to throw Val Kilmer under the bus. I, look, hey, to be fair, Val Kilmer has been in two of my favorite movies of the 21st century, which were Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and MacGruber. So,
hey.
So there's that. And it's looking like Joseph Kosinski may direct this movie, too. And Joseph Kosinski directed Tom Cruise once before in the movie Oblivion. And he also directed Tron Legacy. And I never saw Tron Legacy, but I saw Oblivion. Because I really love Tom Cruise, and I'll basically watch him in anything. Yeah. Oblivion is really bad. It's, I don't, have you seen Oblivion?
I have. I remember liking it, but I don't remember anything. I don't remember why or like anything about it. So.
I remember being so bored, but like so visually enthralled. I think that movie, like visually, is kind of insane.
I think that was probably it. Yeah.
Like visually, it's really incredible. And from what I've heard about Tron Legacy, it's the same deal there. But yeah. I just remember Oblivion ripping off every single sci-fi movie that's ever existed.
And I think now that I'm remembering the twist. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. I remember thinking that might have been intentional. Like, it seemed like an homage to like all science fiction. There's like the twist that's very reminiscent of Moon. There's homages to like 2001: A Space Odyssey, and there's a Planet of the Apes thing where you see the Statue of Liberty in the rubble or whatever. And there's like a Star Wars trench run at one point, and it's like it's literally all the sci-fi in one, and that seems like something I should fucking love. But I just I just remember thinking it was very boring and very like repetitive and very a dull movie. And so I don't know about Joe Kosinski directing Top Gun 2, but it'll probably look really nice at least if that's the case.
So it's got that going for it.
But I guess this would probably focus on like more, like they talked about Top Gun 2 in the past and what it would be. And it sounds like it would be more modernized and like drone, having to do with drone warfare rather than like fighter pilots and stuff like that. So there could be an interesting angle to take with Top Gun 2. I don't think it will probably take that angle. It's a Top Gun movie. you know, it's going to be mostly like cheesiness and shirtless volleyball scenes. And that's like,
It's 80 minutes of volleyball and 10 minutes of fighter things.
I mean, you got to give people what they want. So that is apparently a thing that's happening, Top Gun 2. So throwing that out there. And then I have a lot of really sad news to report now coming down the pike. A lot of my favorite celebrities died over the past few weeks, which is very upsetting, very disappointing. And so I'm going to go through the list of them here.
That's such a terrible way that you have to put that.
No, I mean, what I'm going to do, I'm going to name one, and then I'm just going to mention a few of their stuff that's it, that they're in. If you have like a favorite performance of theirs, you can throw that out there, Mike.
Sure.
All right. So the first one is Michael Parks, who's one of my favorite character actors. He was huge in Quentin Tarantino movies and Robert Rodriguez movies, Kevin Smith movies. He's in a lot of stuff. He was probably most well-known to film geeks as Sheriff Earl McGraw in a couple of different Tarantino and Rodriguez movies. I think he plays that in both Kill Bills and
Death Proof. I think
Death Proof and Planet of Terror. He plays that role.
Yeah.
And he's in, I think he's in From Dusk Till Dawn, I think, playing that same role. And he's in a bunch of that stuff. And he's also Jean Renault on Twin Peaks.
That's probably my favorite just because.
Yeah. And
it's Twin Peaks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, Twin Peaks is awesome, and he was great on that show. And he was also, I mean, in Kill Bill Volume 2, he played two roles. He played Earl McGraw in the beginning, and then he played was Esteban Viejo, the Spanish guy at the end, who knows Bill and like is able to lead the bride to Bill. And it's, like, I think that's kind of it's so remarkable to me that he was both of those characters, because he is unrecognizable as Esteban Viejo, and he does like such an incredibly different performance. I did not know it was him. I knew he was Sheriff McGraw the first time I saw the movie.
Right.
And then I did not know it was him until like a couple of times seeing Kill Bill. And I was like, oh my God, that's also Michael Parks. That's insane. That is insane. But in recent years, he became a little bit more well known for being in Kevin Smith movies. He was in Kevin Smith famously like made movies that were built around Michael Park's performances. Like, he just wanted to make, like, that was most of the reason that Red State exists was because he wanted Michael Parks to do like a 15 minute monologue.
Really?
Have you seen Red State? There's literally like,
I have not. Okay. I know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of late period Kevin Smith, but I do like Red State quite a bit, or I did back in the day. And there's like a 10 minute long scene of them in a church, and it's Michael Parks as the preacher just monologuing, and it's menacing, and it's cool, and it's very awesome. And then Michael Parks was also the bad guy in Tusk as well.
Right.
And he is he single-handedly makes Tusk worth watching.
Wow.
Other than like the weirdness of watching Tusk, and it's like Tusk is an odd movie. But yeah, so Michael Parks, very upset about that one. And then another one of my favorite character actors died over the past few weeks, and that is Powers Booth, who was in Deadwood. He was pretty well known for being in Deadwood as Cy Tolliver. He was in Sin City as Senator O'Rourke. And of course, there's my favorite of his roles, MacGruber. This is a very MacGruber-heavy podcast.
When is it not?
But he plays Colonel Faith in MacGruber, MacGruber's commanding officer. And he's the straight man in that movie, but he's just so good at it. And he's perfect at it. And he has this very like commanding voice that was really intense and great. And he was also in The Avengers briefly. He played one of the World Security Council that Nick Fury like reports to. And then he reprised that role on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And it was kind of the big bad for the third season of that show. And so that was very cool to see him on that show too. And, you know, that was very upsetting. Do you have a favorite Powers Booth performance, Mike?
You know, I don't think I do off the top of my head. Okay. I know he's one of those guys that's in everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and I can't place anyone.
He's somebody that you notice as soon as he's,
exactly.
He was,
yeah.
I think he was in Tombstone also.
Oh,
big role there. Yeah.
Yes.
Tombstone, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is. So yeah, there's Powers Booth. And then I did want to mention this. This isn't specifically a film-related one, but this one was cut pretty deep. Was Chris Cornell, lead singer of Soundgarden, Audioslave, and Temple of the Dog. Hugely influential 90s musician died. And like I'm a pretty huge Soundgarden fan, pretty huge alternative rock fan, and so that was a huge blow. But also I wanted to mention him because he did the theme song for Casino Royale, the first Daniel Craig James Bond movie, and I think it's one of the best James Bond themes. Like it is a really really strong one. That's called You Know My Name if you want to look that up, but that's a really strong theme song, and really like it just kicks off that era of James Bond in a really good way, I think.
Yeah Audioslave was one of the first bands for me that like in, you know, eighth or ninth grade, like getting in, finally figuring out like what kind of music I like as like an individual. And Audioslave was one of those first bands that I found that I was like, this is what rock and roll is supposed to be like. So Chris Cornell was definitely a huge influence on me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to mention him. And then also Lisa Spoonhauer, who played Caitlin Bree in Clerks, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Again, like I'm a huge fan of early period Kevin Smith, not as much late period Kevin Smith, but Clerks, hugely formative movie for me. And like Lisa Spoonhauer, who played Caitlin Bree, Dante's ex-girlfriend, who comes back at the end and fucks a dead guy. That's
only in a Kevin Smith movie only would you be Kevin able to Smith. Say that sentence.
I feel like a lot of the credit for that movie goes to Dante and Randall and Jane Silent Bob. Like those are the people who people tend to remember. But I feel like Lisa Spoonhauer as Caitlin, and also Marilyn Gigliotti as the other girlfriend. I'm blanking on her name right now. They never get enough credit for being as good as they are in that movie. I feel like everybody in the movie is really firing on all cylinders, and it's just really I like, you know, listening to the dialogue of that movie. Like they're. Is a lot of like really intricate dialogue that is done in one take. Like, it's,
yeah.
Like you can see, like there's just no cutting and the camera will just sit still for 10 minutes and let these people talk. And I love Clerks. That was a very formative movie for me. And I think it's kind of, if I watched it for the first time now, I might not like it as much. You know, it's just cause like, it's such an amateurish movie almost. Like it feels like,
yeah,
you know, but it's so, I think, raw in a way.
Yeah, it's very much, I think, about young adulthood, right? Like, or speaks to that viewer so much more than I think it does to a fully formed, quote unquote, mature adult, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Lisa Spoonhauer is great in that movie. And Kevin Smith wrote up a really long post about her on his Instagram, I think, and his Facebook. And so that was really nice to see. And then, of course, this is the big one. Roger Moore, the iconic James Bond actor. Died at like 89, I think he was.
He
was very old. I think he's older than Sean Connery, or like just almost as old as Sean Connery.
I don't know. I don't remember.
But he's the first James Bond to die. That's the first one.
Wow,
is,
yeah,
insane. And Roger Moore was never like my favorite Bond, but in a lot of his movies, like he is James Bond. That's the thing. I feel like, you know, with Sean Connery, he was James Bond, but he also went on to other things. And he's also recognizable in several other roles. So it's like he's Sean Connery. He's not James Bond. Roger Moore is James Bond because I feel like he was James Bond for the longest for I think it's like 7 movies over like 12 years, something like that. But also like he wasn't really in a ton of stuff after Bond. And so I feel like he is so like ingrained with that character. And, The Spy Who Loved Me is like all time James Bond. That's one of my favorite Bond movies. So that was, very upsetting to hear that. And of course it's like Live and Let Die and The Man with the Golden Gun, Moonraker.
Yeah. I think it's so funny. Like, the different kinds of Bond, right? You know, Sean Connery is like the sexy suave.
Right.
And Roger Moore's era is just so silly hilarious. Like, that's the best part of all those movies, and it's so much fun.
Absolutely. So RIP to all those people. That was a very upsetting few weeks. And then I did want to I do have more sad news, unfortunately. Zack Snyder has stepped down from his Justice League duties after a family tragedy. His daughter actually committed suicide. And so that is insane. Not news that I had ever expected to see. And I guess it happened back in March. And he's just stepping down now. I guess he, like, once it happened, like, he took some, like, there was like a 2-week break in filming so he can grieve and mourn with his family and stuff. And then from there, he, like, dived right back into filming to take his mind off things. And, like, he was working with the studio, and the studio was, like, apparently very accommodating with him. They were like, we can move the release date, we can delay things and all that. Like, they seemed very understanding about it, which is good. But, you know, at this point, Zack Snyder, I guess the movie is basically filmed at this point.
Like,
it's pretty much shot. And so it's mostly post-production at this point that still has to do and maybe like the filming of some additional scenes. So Zack Snyder is stepping down from his Justice League duties for the remainder of the movie making process. Also, Deborah Snyder, his wife, is also taking time off. She was a producer on the movie. And Joss Whedon is filling in, actually, which is kind of insane. And he's seeing the project to completion, which is, like I said, mostly post-production at this point with some additional scenes to be shot. I guess Whedon was already going to like write in a couple of extra scenes for the Justice League like before all this happened. So he was already kind of involved because we mentioned before Joss Whedon is attached to direct Batgirl from DC, and so I guess he's part of that. He's part of the DC family now. He switched sides from Marvel to DC. But so it's kind of insane that Joss Whedon is going to be finishing up this. But if like that's like beautiful hands. And like we talk about Zack Snyder a lot on this show.
This one hits real close to the show. This one hits home.
And we have pretty strong feelings about some of Zack Snyder's DC movies, but no one should have to go through this, and
it's
really shitty. And I love Joss Whedon, so I think if this is in anybody's hands, that's I'm glad that it's in his. I think this will still mostly be Zack Snyder's movie.
I think this is Whedon helping a friend out, maybe. It's just post-production and a few reshoots or extra scenes or something. So
a couple of additional scenes. So we'll see how this all shakes out for Justice League. I think the movie will be mostly unaffected by all this. We'll see what happens. What are the odds that Justice League is a good movie, Mike? What do you think?
Don't ask me that after this story. I don't know. After the success, hopefully, fingers crossed, of Wonder Woman, maybe.
I think there has been a huge turnaround in what DC has been doing over the past few months. Wonder Woman has been getting very positive early reactions. And it sounds like Justice League, they've shifted the tone of that movie a lot. And like they've listened to the response that Batman v Superman got. And it sounds like, they're really trying to make something really good.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? If they actually listened to and heeded the backlash of against everything being so dark, the Snyderverse that we joke about all the time, which we may have to retire out of respect for a little while.
Yeah, we'll probably keep that joke down to a minimum for the time being.
Yeah, I think they always have the potential to be really good and refreshing. So hopefully it is.
Yeah. All right, so that that wraps up film news. We had a lot of sad stuff to report towards the end there. Not everything can be as fun as talking about Top Gun 2.
But I have 10 more minutes on whatever our first topic was. Venom. I don't even remember anymore.
It was so long ago. My beard has grown 2 inches since then. So we should get out of film news, Mike. Let's move on into our discussion. Watch this.
These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time to get into our discussions on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So I have two things. Well, I guess technically seven things, but to talk about. But six of them are all one thing.
Yeah,
it's gonna make sense. I promise.
Sure. Why not?
The first thing, real quick. Fuck you, Tom Cruise is the Mummy. The real Mummy is 1999. Brendan Fraser, the Mummy.
I mean, okay, the real Mummy is, you know, the 1930s look, Boris Karloff. I mean,
just... right, don't split hairs here, Mike. Okay. Yeah, my friends and I, a few of us, were talking about the upcoming The Mummy with Tom Cruise that we talked about, and how originally that they looked awful in that first trailer I saw, but now I might be turning around on it. But I wanted to throw it back and rewatch the 1999 The Mummy starring Brendan Fraser, because I remember seeing that in theaters and being terrified and having so much fun. And I rewatched it, and it holds up. It's silly, fun, adventure, bombastic silliness.
Yeah.
And it's Brendan Fraser at his peak, so like, what's not to like?
Yeah, there was a short-lived time where Brendan Fraser was a huge movie star.
He's actually got a very tragic story.
I really don't know his backstory or anything. I know.
Yeah, I remember reading about he suffered some kind of back injury that prevented him from being able to be in action movies anymore.
Really?
And was just never cast in movies again. And then his wife divorced him and took all his money.
Oh, man. Ouch.
Yeah. So, tragic twist to Brendan Fraser's story.
That's upsetting.
Well,
I know he's on, he has like a recurring role on The Affair, I think, on Showtime. I think he's on that show.
Yeah.
I think the Fraser-essence could be coming back, you know.
What's one more actor?
The Brendan-essence.
Oh my god. Then the other six things I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Was a joint adventure, Mike. We went on an adventure last week. I don't know if you remember.
I recall.
We went to the Hudson Horror Show, which was a 6-movie, 12-hour marathon in a shitty $2 movie theater.
Oh, yeah.
And it was wonderful. It was six ridiculous B cheesy horror movies.
Yes.
Well, not all of them were horror, I guess.
Yeah, and not all of them were cheesy and like... You know.
Yeah, there was just a lot of schlock funness,
yeah, exactly.
I guess.
Yeah, it was a good mix of a lot of different stuff.
Yeah. The first movie we watched was Frankenhooker, which tells you everything you need to know about
right
that movie.
Title. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next movie we watched was Slaughterhouse, was just this weird 80s, late 80s slasher movie about these guys protecting their slaughterhouse that the bank was coming to take.
Yeah.
We watched a mystery movie, which, as per our binding contracts with the Hudson Horror Show, we're not allowed to discuss.
Yes, that's true.
That's exaggerated, but we're not allowed to talk about it.
We're not allowed to say what it is. We can say that it was good, I think, is the...
Yeah. We're not allowed to say the title, right? I think this might have been my favorite movie out of the whole marathon. It was something that I was never expecting, and it was fucking awesome.
Yeah, so there you go. It's a shame that we can't actually say what it is, so people... But if you see Mike on the street and you want to know what movie it was, he'll tell you.
Yeah, let me know or shoot me a Twitter DM or something, maybe. I don't know. They didn't specify.
Yeah, as long as it's not made public.
Exactly. The next movie we watched was Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. I am not particularly well-versed in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, but I've heard this is the best one. And it was really cool.
The best sequel, let's say, because the original is the best one.
Yeah. Out of the 19,000 sequels, right. This is the best one. Best one.
I mean, this one was written by Wes Craven has a story credit on this one,
right?
And also Frank Darabont wrote this one. Also, he directed Shawshank Redemption, and The Mist, and created The Walking Dead. He's a pretty big.
Yeah, and it was really cool. Is this like one of Patricia Arquette's first movies? Maybe I don't know.
I
she looked
so,
really
yeah.
young.
Patricia Arquette is the lead of this movie. Yeah, and also Lawrence Fishburne is in Dream Warriors.
Yeah, as
cool.
Credited as Larry Fishburne. Which was awesome. The next movie we watched was The Hidden, starring Kyle MacLachlan in some late 80s sci-fi, pre-Twin Peaks, pre-X-Files, alien cop drama.
Yeah, this was my favorite one of the festival. I like this one.
It's a toss-up between The Hidden, probably The Hidden first for me, too, and then the mystery movie. And then the last movie we watched was Piranha, The 19—I don't even know this movie came out.
1978, directed by Joe Dante, my man.
Friend of the show, Joe Dante.
He retweeted me on Twitter once.
There you go. Yeah, that's enough.
We've communicated actually, because I talked about—I was talking about his movie Matinee, and he responded back, and I was like, "Yes,
that's awesome."
But yeah, I'm a big Joe Dante fan. I had never seen Piranha. And I had seeked it out. I had looked for Piranha in the past, and I had never been able to find it. You know, it's...
Well, good news for you, Mike.
Yeah, I...
You won a DVD.
I did. I won a DVD of Joe Dante's Piranha because I am the only person who knows everything about the Piranha 3D remake.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. That's the kind of thing we were at, listeners. That Mike won a DVD of the original Piranha for his Piranha 3D trivia knowledge.
of which I have a lot.
Yeah, but Piranha is just a silly Jaws ripoff spoof thing, and it was way funnier than I was ever expecting for what I had heard about this movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a good times. 13 hours or 12 hours or whatever of silly, intense, awesome movies.
Yeah, it was a long time, and I've done a couple of these marathon things in the past. I did the Rocky marathon at the Draft House, and I did the Schwarzenegger marathon at the Draft House. And this was the first time, my first non-Draft House marathon, and I really enjoyed being there. But after a while, you feel it, like you feel that you've been there for 13 hours. Whereas at the Draft House, you get the comfortable seats, you got the food coming in all the time, and it's like I feel like in this one, it was like a fight for survival almost.
We went through something.
We sat there among a bunch of freaks.
Yeah, surviving on popcorn for 8 of those 12 hours.
Yeah, because we didn't realize that we were able to bring our own food.
Yeah, rookie mistake.
So, like, after the first movie, we, like, bolted to fucking Wendy's and came back. And then it's like, all right, now we have to subsist on popcorn nachos for the rest of the day.
And I think we did all right.
Yeah, we did fine. We did fine. So that was the Hudson Horror Show and The Mummy. And then I have a few things I want to talk about, and the first of which you've also watched at least some of, Mike. Twin Peaks is back, man.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. Yeah, it's finally here. The first 4 episodes of what could potentially be one of the best things I've ever seen.
But like maybe not, but maybe like it's
I mean, holy shit, dude. So you've seen the first 2 episodes. I've seen the first 4.
Yes.
You got to watch episodes 3 and 4 as soon as you can. But yeah, it is unreal. Just how all in the show goes, you know. It is insane. You know, we've both talked a lot in the past about how big fans we are of Twin Peaks. I believe I chronicled. I didn't really chronicle my entire watch through of Twin Peaks, but I've mentioned the fact that I was watching it a lot as I was watching it and where I was and stuff. So my fandom of Twin Peaks has been chronicled on this show quite a lot in the past, and I went all in on Twin Peaks. I bought like the books and I got into like all this other stuff. So I was very excited about this new return. Also, very like not just that it was Twin Peaks returning, the fact that David Lynch is writing and directing every single episode, and it's 18 episodes, which is a lot for.
Wait, I didn't know it was 18 episodes. I thought it was 10 or something. Oh my god!
It is 18 episodes, sir. And David Lynch is directing and co-writing every single one, along with Mark Frost, the other guy who co-created Twin Peaks. And this show has gone all in. It is uncompromising. It is intense. I often do not know what I'm watching. But I love every second of it, and it fucking terrifies me. Like, I was so unsettled by a lot of the stuff in Twin Peaks this new season. In a way that like I would get unsettled by watching the original stuff, but like I feel like there's a difference in the way in the unsettling nature of it because that was a network TV show.
Right.
And this is cable, and it has so much more freedom, and it literally is Showtime just giving David Lynch a bunch of money to make whatever he wanted. And it's kind of insane. And also David Lynch has not directed anything in more than 10 years. Inland Empire was his last movie in 2006. And he hasn't directed any kind of narrative feature or TV show or anything since then. The closest thing to it, he directed a Duran Duran concert back in like 2011 because of course like, he did.
Yeah, naturally.
But
I think it's you know I'm thinking back to when we did the Leftovers mid-season check-in, and I remember one of the things I talked about was when it's one of the few shows on TV that doesn't care if the audience is coming along with it, right? Like what it's just going to do what it's going to do.
Yeah.
And this is David Lynch going to 11. Like
Twin Peaks makes the Leftovers look like Blue Bloods. Like it's
yeah, It's the Big Bang Theory compared to this. Like, it's David Lynch giving the double bird to everyone, but like not in a fuck you kind of way. It's like a fuck you, join me, won't you? Yeah, like,
it's like, this is how it's done kind of way.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. Twin Peaks like was such an iconic show when it first hit, and it was such an influential show. Like, every TV show since Twin Peaks has some kind of debt to pay to Twin Peaks, you know? Like, The Leftovers is hugely influenced by Twin Peaks. Even in the trailers for Twin Peaks before the new season started, I would see, like, you know, promos for him. And Damon Lindelof was in them talking about, like, how big Twin Peaks was for him. And also, like, the guy who made Ray Donovan is in them because it's a Showtime show. And what's kind of crazy about these episodes is that it almost echoes a lot of the shows that have come after Twin Peaks. I feel like there's the kind of two senses The Leftovers has. There's part of it that takes place in South Dakota, and there's like a prolonged comedy bit that would feel right in place with Fargo, you know?
It definitely feels a lot like David Lynch being like, yes, welcome, like, come home, my children. Yeah. Like, definitely, like you said, most of the time in those first two episodes, I had no idea what the fuck I'm watching. I also think it's interesting that it might be a semantics thing, but like, they're calling them parts, right?
Yes.
Instead of episodes. And I definitely, from those first two parts, get the feeling that David Lynch just made an 18-hour movie.
I think that's what he said. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. It's so good.
Yeah. And it's nuts. And I feel like a lot of times that like the showrunners will say like, oh, we actually envisioned this as like a 13-hour movie or whatever. And a lot of times I hate that because I feel like TV is like an episodic medium. And so you need to kind of build like an episode. It needs to have some kind of importance. But I feel like David Lynch's thing, I'm all in on whatever he does, you know?
Right.
But I feel like every episode does feel like its own thing. But while also serving this larger purpose, but at the same time, yes, it does feel like a gigantic 18-hour movie, and I'm loving it so much. The end of episode 2 and the first half hour of episode 3 is some of the most insane shit I've ever seen in my entire life. It is balls to the wall bananas, and then it veers into comedy so quickly and so easily, and it's just so great, man. I mean, especially the second half of episode 3 and episode 4 are really funny.
That's amazing.
Really funny in like that very uncomfortable David Lynch way where it's like, I don't know why this is funny. I don't know how this is funny. I don't know if this is funny, but like,
but I'm laughing.
But I'm laughing. I really want to talk to you about this. I don't know if you have seen anything about episodes 3 and 4. But there is an actor who shows up in episode 4 who has this very long extended comedy bit. It goes on for like 8 minutes. And it's the best thing I've ever seen. It's become very divisive. A lot of people really hate it. That makes me love it more.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, I am so interested to just dissect and have my mind blown every time I think about these things. Like, I can't even tell you what happens exactly at the end of episode 2. Like, I don't think I was able to process it. Like, what I was watching. I don't even remember.
I mean, I'm planning on rewatching all the episodes before episode five airs. I got to carve out 4 hours of my time to rewatch them, and I'm glad to do it. I am so all in on this. This is blowing me away in a way that like even I couldn't have predicted. And I feel like David Lynch is really like onto something here. Like, this could be like his magnum opus.
It feels like that. It is, yeah.
Like this feels like real event television, which is of the sort that doesn't get made that much anymore. And so I'm just very excited for the rest of the season. And I think I might use this discussions segment of our podcast to just talk about Twin Peaks for the entire summer.
It'll be our mini Twin Peaks podcast that we had always talked about.
We had talked about doing a Twin Peaks podcast, and then we decided, no, that's too much work. But
we already can't handle the two that we have right now. So
it has been 3 weeks since our last podcast. that was a pipe dream at best, but we can set aside 10 minutes an episode to talk about Twin Peaks, and I think that's fine.
Quote unquote 10 minutes.
Yeah,
we'll set aside a Marvel 10 minutes.
The gentleman's hour and a half. So I did want to talk about Twin Peaks, and that is really incredible. And then I also wanted to briefly mention that I rewatched the entire Alien franchise leading up to Alien Covenant. And you know, Alien and Aliens are awesome, right? We are all always big fans of Alien and Aliens. And then from there, I feel like everybody hates the rest of the Alien franchise. the rest of the franchise. Right? Doesn't it, it feels like that. Like, everybody's like, the first two movies are very good, and then the rest of it sucks.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I rewatched the entire franchise, and there is some bad stuff. I will say, I did not watch the Alien vs. Predator movies. I did not rewatch those because I'm not going to put myself through that. But I rewatched Alien and Aliens, and then I rewatched Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, and Prometheus, leading up to Alien Covenant. And Alien Resurrection is garbage. I'll give you that.
Everyone's right about that one.
Everyone is right about Alien Resurrection. It's really bad. It's written by Joss Whedon, who is great. And there's like oddly like Whedon-esque moments every once in a while, but for the most part, that movie does not work at all, and it gets super fucking weird, which is normally something I like. And I think it is something you really got to watch to believe what happens at the end of Alien Resurrection.
All right.
But anyway, that's not really what I want to talk about. I want to talk about Alien 3, and I want to talk about Prometheus, because I found myself really digging Alien 3 upon this rewatch. And I did watch the assembly cut of Alien 3, which is the much longer, almost director's cut version of Alien 3. So David Fincher directed Alien 3. He's one of my favorite directors. But the consensus around Alien 3 is that it was his first movie, and the production was very troubled going into that one. Like, there was a lot of issues on set. There was the studio was breathing down David Fincher's back the entire time. And what ended up being released in theaters was a very truncated version of what David Fincher had originally envisioned.
Right.
And so there's the assembly cut, which is on the Blu-ray, which I have. Which is about 40 minutes longer. It's the first time I watched the assembly cut. And it locks in. Everything locks into place, I feel like, in this cut. It still has problems, but it is a dirty, like, nasty, self-contained, really violent action thriller. And I was all in. Like, I really dug Alien 3. I think it is really interesting. I think it has a really cool premise. And it's totally its own thing. So while it's a bummer that it kills off two fan favorite characters from Aliens within the first 5 minutes, off screen, I should say.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. But what do you mean?
We'll save it.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I wouldn't call her a fan favorite, but
sure.
But anyway, in Alien 3, it kills off Hicks and Newt. Which,
right.
You know, that happens off screen in the first 5 minutes of the movie. And yeah, that is kind of a bummer, but I feel like it builds on that very well. And like the movie that it creates out of that is really entertaining. And I love the premise of this movie, which has Ripley crash landing. Have you seen Alien 3?
I think I have once, but I had intended to do what, to watch the whole thing, watch the whole franchise again. But I only made it through Alien and Aliens,
okay.
Which like, hey, I think I won either way.
That's fair. But at the end of Aliens, you know, Ripley and Newton Hicks go off in their ship and they're on their way back to Earth.
Right.
And at the beginning of Alien 3, it's revealed that there was actually a xenomorph or a facehugger or whatever still on the ship. And it destroys a couple of the pods and the ship crash lands. And Hicks and Newt both die in the crash. And Ripley survives. And she crash lands on this planet that's like this prison planet from way out in the outer reaches of space where, like, the hardest of hardened criminals go. And so the entire cast is made up of, like, these dirty, like, horrible, like, murderers and rapists and all that stuff. And, like, they're the worst of the worst. They're the Suicide Squad of of alien protagonists.
Do you mean that there were some kind of Aliens 3?
Exactly. But I really love that there's just, like, this nihilistic nature that this movie has, and Charles Dance is in this movie. He's like Tywin Lannister on Game of Thrones. And Charles S. Dutton is the kind of like the ringleader of the prisoners, and he's great. And there's a lot of like really great dark comedy in the movie. There's one bit where everybody's just like arguing with each other, and then the alien pops down from the ceiling and just grabs the dude that the guy is arguing with, and it's the prison warden, and the alien pops out of the ceiling, grabs him, and like brings him up to the ceiling, and everybody just stares at it for a minute, and then the guy who's arguing with him is just like, fuck. just it was the funniest F word I've ever it was pretty great. So Alien 3, highly recommend checking out the assembly cut if you can, because it is a really solid movie. And then I did want to mention Prometheus, because that is a very divisive among Alien fans.
Yeah.
You know, that movie came out, and I remember liking it back when it was in theaters. You know, and I think you also liked Prometheus, right, Mike?
Yeah, Prometheus is one of those movies that I think every time I watch it, I switch. and like I think that's a good thing, I guess, right? Like,
yeah.
It's an interesting movie to grapple with, I guess.
I think it is kind of a mess of a movie, but it's a really visually rich one. Like, I think it's one of the best looking movies I've ever seen. And it tackles a lot of really interesting thematic territory. That's a movie that was written by Damon Lindelof. And I feel like a lot of the stuff in Prometheus is kind of a dry run for what he went on to do with The Leftovers.
That all tracks.
The whole concepts of creation and stuff like that, I think is really interesting. Plus, I mean, that C-section scene in Prometheus is aces. It's incredible. It's some of the best like body horror of Ridley Scott's career. I think it's like up there with anything in the original Alien. It's pretty great. I did want to mention Prometheus is still a very solid movie. It's not great, and I don't even know if I would say it's good. But I think it's really interesting, and it's one that I would rewatch again at some point. So you didn't get the chance to rewatch Prometheus before Alien Covenant?
No, I definitely really wish I did.
Yeah,
though.
There's definitely, probably should have.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird because we'll talk about it in a minute, but it's not really like a direct sequel to Prometheus. It doesn't really have any of the same cast except for Michael Fassbender. But it does build on a lot of the stuff that happened in Prometheus.
Yeah.
And so I think that's interesting, but we'll talk about all that right now, Mike. Should we get into our review?
Let's do it.
All right, let's do that. Let's get into our review of Alien Covenant starting right now.
Karis, please, open up.
I can't do this with an infection.
All right, that was from the trailer for Alien Covenant. And before we get into our review, Mike, there is some breaking film news happening on Twitter right now.
Hot off the presses?
Hot off the presses. The presses are so hot, they are steaming, sir.
That's not a phrase, right?
I mean, it could be. Adam Wingard, the director of such films as Your Next, The Guest, and Blair Witch, he's doing the Death Note movie, which is coming out on Netflix this year, too.
Nice.
One of my favorite directors working today. I really love his stuff, and I'm very excited to see what he does next. And guess what? I know what he's doing next.
Is it Shrek 5?
God damn it. No. It is not Shrek 5. I mean, in an ideal world, yes, Adam Wingard would be directing Shrek 5.
Imagine the weird, creepy horror movie version of Shrek 5 directed by Adam Wingard.
Yeah, no, that's not happening. But what is happening is that Adam Wingard is going to be directing Godzilla versus Kong, Mike. Which is insane.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That is awesome. That is like, he has not worked on a huge budget ever, I don't think. This is going to be a huge, big step up for him as a director in terms of blockbuster filmmaking. And I am just super excited to see this movie now. Like, I really love Godzilla, you know, the Gareth Edwards movie. I was kind of lukewarm on Kong, but I basically liked it. You know, it was fun. I'm very excited about Godzilla 2, which is going to be directed by Mike Doherty, who did Trick or Treat. And now there's Godzilla vs. Kong directed by Adam Wingard. So they're taking all my favorite indie horror directors and they're bringing them, to the monster world. I'm very excited about this, man. This is awesome.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So we'll have more on that story, I guess, next episode, if there's more to talk about other than just Adam Wingard's directing it. But until then, Mike, we should get into our review. Is that right?
I think it's time.
All right. So we are reviewing Alien Covenant today, the new film directed by Ridley Scott. It stars Michael Fassbender, Catherine Waterston, Billy Crudup, Danny McBride, Demian Bashir, Carmen Ejogo, and Amy Simetz, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis of the Alien Covenant movie reads, "The crew of a colony ship bound for a remote planet discover an uncharted paradise with a threat beyond their imagination and must attempt a harrowing escape."
Ooh.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good plot synopsis from IMDb. I'll give them credit for that.
Good job. Yeah, good job, IMDb.
Yeah, so first of all, I think I mentioned this before, but it is really quite amazing that I was able to see a new Alien movie from Ridley Scott and new Twin Peaks from David Lynch this weekend. I think that is that is just a very nice thing for me. I'm very happy about that. So I said this right before we started, but Alien Covenant builds on the ideas of Prometheus, while at the same time, it also kind of feels like Ridley Scott is responding to how people reacted to Prometheus a little bit, right?
Yeah.
You know, Prometheus is a very non-traditional Alien movie, I feel like. Like, Alien...
Not even in the title.
This is very true. you know, Prometheus is a more cerebral Alien movie, I guess. Like, I feel like there is Alien horror to be had in that movie, but I feel like it's much more about the exploration than anything else. And that's always been a factor in the Alien movies, but I feel like Prometheus lays that on much heavier. And it also introduces a lot of, like, really heavy thematic territory that the Alien movies have never really had up till that point.
Yeah, from what I remember, when Prometheus was being promoted and stuff, that it was, like, not even being called an Alien movie, right? If I remember, it was, like, a spiritual successor thing.
Yeah, I think originally it was just going to be, like, a different sci-fi movie that happened.
Yeah, just, like, set in that universe or something.
Maybe not even that. It was just, like, a sci-fi movie that, like, Damon Lindelof was writing for Ridley Scott, and then halfway through they were like, oh, we're, like, we're sort of going to be an Alien prequel, but, like, maybe not, and, like, everybody was like, wait, what? Like, what's happening?
Excuse me?
And so there was a lot of anticipation for Prometheus going in, because that was, you know, Ridley Scott returning to the Alien universe. Like, that was a huge deal. And the movie that came out, it's a mess. It's a bit of a mess. It's it got a pretty mixed reaction from fans online, to say the least. I feel like there's a lot of negative chatter about Prometheus over the past 5 years. But I feel like that movie's reputation has grown at least a little bit recently. I feel like I've seen more people coming out of the blue book and being like, you know what, Prometheus actually has some cool things happening in it, you know? I mean, that's me. Yeah. That's me. That's one voice.
I'm going to project that onto the whole internet.
Not the whole internet, just a select elite few.
Right. That are better than the rest.
So I do think this movie kind of responds to a lot of the complaints that people had with Prometheus, that movie was much more cerebral and less horror-focused. And so Alien Covenant, I think, doubles down on being a movie that's more like Alien, while also building on the themes of Prometheus. I think it does that pretty well for the most part. I think it's it spends a lot less time on its thematic undertones than Prometheus does. But at the same time, I think it delivers what it sets out to do. And I think it delivers a lot of really cool alien stuff happening and good stuff. I mean, this has also been kind of a divisive movie coming out of it. I think it's gotten slightly better reviews than Prometheus had. But a lot of people are like, this movie sucks. It's weird because it's divisive just like Prometheus was. But it's divisive for, like, entirely different reasons. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Alien Covenant manages to do a bit of both. Like you were just saying, I'm not sure it manages to do both particularly well. Well, actually, that's not true. I think the first half of this movie is a really awesome alien movie. I think we have a return to creepy Ridley Scott horror stuff. Doing his alien thing, and then we veer off to do the Prometheus stuff, which I have come around on a bit. So like I was saying, kind of every time I view Prometheus, I bounce back and forth. And I think that that Alien Covenant manages to, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm interested in rewatching Prometheus after Alien Covenant to see if it elevates Prometheus in some weird way. Because I think Alien Covenant manages to take some of those questions and ask them further, ask them different ways, come at, you know, take them to their next logical step. And I wonder how that translates to the original question, right? I think it's asking a lot of really bold, intense, interesting things. And I'm not particularly sure it gets to a satisfying answer just as far as a story arc would go, right, in a movie. Right. But I still think that Ridley Scott in this movie being willing to go to that, like being willing to ask that question in this weird monster movie is interesting. And I definitely applaud it for that effort, even if it doesn't get all the way to where I would hope it would get to. Yeah.
That's actually really interesting, because I was a lot more enthralled with the second half of this movie than I was the first half. And it seems like you responded the opposite way.
Yeah, well, I don't want to come down on the second half of the movie. I just think it's such an interesting tonal shift from the first half, where craziness and fucking spines exploding, to hold on, we need to have a discussion on the human need to create, which is like, it's awesome. I'm there for it. I'm there for that deep philosophical discussion. But it's just such an interesting difference from the beginning of the movie.
And that is interesting. I was actually listening to the Slash Filmcast review of Alien Covenant. And I don't want to parrot the things that were said on a different podcast. But I think it is interesting that, these are a lot of the themes that are in Blade Runner.
Right.
And And so it's kind of weird that Ridley Scott is transposing them onto the Alien movies as opposed to just making Blade Runner 2, which is right. happening. Like that's
without him. Yeah.
Well, he's producing it, but that's a thing that's happening that he could have directed if he wanted to. You know,
right?
I think if they were making a Ridley, new Blade Runner movie, I'm sure the first person they asked was Ridley Scott. You know,
right? You would hope so, right?
And so that's really interesting there. And so what I do kind of appreciate about these Alien movies, Prometheus and Alien Covenant, is that there's very few movies made on this scale that tackle those kind of themes. And I think that's valuable for them in any case. So I think that's really cool. I think that's kind of why I respond to these movies a little more than a lot of people do. And I do think this is a better movie than Prometheus is. I will say
yes.
that. I do think Prometheus is a more interesting one, if only because there's a lot of stuff to dissect in terms of the flawed way it tells its story. And
right.
And it's a flawed movie, and I think it's one that's really interesting to unpack. But I think this one's just better made, and maybe even because it's better made and because it gets to point across more clearly, it's less interesting than Prometheus is. Like, it's a very weird dichotomy that I have in my
head
with these movies.
Yeah, that because Prometheus is somewhat muddled and messy and you have to work through a lot, it feels more interesting. Which, I mean, you might not necessarily be wrong, right? There's a lot that allows you to come at things from so many more different ways. I don't know if that's how you would fry.
Right.
It's late. whereas a more straightforward discussion is seems less interesting, right?
Because yeah, exactly.
there's less confusion.
Yeah, exactly. I will say that Ridley Scott, still one of the best visual filmmakers working. Like, I talked about Prometheus. That movie is one of the best looking movies I've ever seen. And I don't think this movie has quite that same level for me, but I think the movies always look incredible, and this one looks a lot closer to the aesthetic of the original Alien. And you know, that's part of the idea, he wanted to get away from the kind of hyper polished environment of Prometheus and do something a little grungier and a little dirtier.
Yeah.
And I think that he accomplishes that here, and I think it looks really, really cool. I will say the characters feel a lot less distinctive than this than they could be.
Yes.
And the only ones that really stand out to me are Catherine Waterston, Danny McBride, and Michael Fassbender, of course. Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
Michael Fassbender, it's actually unreal how good he is in this movie. I think he is,
phenomenal. I mean, literally.
Yes, that's true. But I think he plays such a range of emotion within an emotionless character so perfectly. And I think he's just perfect in these movies. And I would be okay if Ridley Scott just wants to make 6 David movies. Because I think those are the movies that I think he really wants to make are these movies focused on Michael Fassbender's David.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of what Prometheus was about, and that's kind of what this movie is about. And so I think he's way more interested in what's happening with Fassbender's character than he is with anything else that's happening in these movies, including Alien stuff.
Which, like you said, I hate to parrot the Slash Filmcast, but that even begs the question even more. That Blade Runner is explicitly about androids and humanity. And he picked the Alien movies to do that in.
Yeah. I think it's mostly just circumstance the way it happened. I'm sure he was working on that. We were talking about Prometheus was kind of sort of an Alien prequel for a while. It was on the fence. Nobody really knew what it was. And so I think that was a different sci-fi movie that they ended up making into an Alien movie. And there was a whole lot of stuff going on there. And so I think, the Blade Runner sequel was rumored for a long time, but finally just got off the ground recently. And so I think he just never got the opportunity to make it in a Blade Runner sequel, but that's fine.
It's whatever.
It's kind of what I think if these were just straight Alien movies, they might still be good. But I think they wouldn't be as cool to talk about almost, in that sense. Cause if you're just going to make a straight Alien movie, there's no way it's going to be as good as Alien or Aliens, So it's
And I think it is interesting, right? Just in terms of the themes of Prometheus and Alien Covenant, and I don't think you can talk about one movie without talking about the other anymore, or at least Alien Covenant without Prometheus. The theme of what it means to create and what it means to make art, and is that the defining human characteristic, right? It's so interesting to think of Ridley Scott as a man in his later years coming back to the franchise he created to have this discussion, which I think just makes it all the more interesting. That makes Alien Covenant and Prometheus the questions that they're asking.
Absolutely. I really think Guy Pearce's character is an analog for Ridley Scott. Guy Pearce's character is Peter Weyland, who's the creator of David, and he's talking to they have a prologue scene at the beginning of this movie, and they Guy Pearce appears in Prometheus as well for like 5 minutes total in each movie. But you know, his whole thing is that he's contemplating the existence of creation, and like he created David, so that sort of makes him David's god in a way. And so he wants to know who created him, and there's like the whole chain going on there. And I think that I think those are questions that Ridley Scott is actually asking himself, and like trying to figure it out through these movies.
Right.
You know, those answers. And look, those aren't questions that he'll ever have answers to. But it's really interesting to dive in and discuss them.
Definitely the is it the architects or engineers? I don't remember.
Engineers.
Right. If the engineers created the humans, created humanity in Prometheus, and then, or you know, whatever the, not in the timeline, but we're told that in Prometheus, and then humans create androids who destroy the humans, the humans wanted to destroy the engineers. Like, it's a whole weird, your creation will one day be more than you and will destroy you. I mean, that prologue scene is weird and really intense, but I love that kind of like deep philosophical.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me, one of my favorite exchanges in Prometheus, it's been a little while since you've seen it, right? So I might need to refresh your memory. There's the bit, I think it's like halfway through the movie, David has poisoned a drink that he's giving to, I think, Logan Marshall Green's character is the actor's name. And there's talking, they're having a discussion. And, you know, Logan Marshall Green and Noomir Pace, their whole thing is they want to meet the people who created them. They want to meet their makers. They want to meet their gods. And so David comes up to them and he's like, why do you want to be here? And Logan Marshall Green's like, we want to meet our makers and we want to know the question of why they created us. And David asks, well, why do you think they created me? And Logan Marshall Green's like, because we could. And David's like, do you realize how disappointing that answer would be if you, if you got that? And that like conversation like blows my mind. That's such a deep philosophical thought. That's in the middle of this, you know, space alien movie.
He's poisoning drinks, like
and so I think that exchange is kind of at the heart of Covenant as well. You know, I think Ridley Scott has basically reinvented this franchise into like a meditation on life and creation, rather than just being alien monster movies. And and the alien monster movies are awesome; they're great. And like Alien and Aliens are better movies than Prometheus and Alien Covenant. I will say, I will say that.
But I think it's a weird, like, it feels unfair to even compare Prometheus and Alien Covenant to Alien and Aliens. They're they're attempting two very different things.
That's true. They're in the same franchise, but they are completely different in terms of what they're going for. Prometheus is kind of about discovering where we came from, and Alien Covenant is like more interested in what happens to us once we know that answer. Because they meet the guys who created them at the end of Prometheus, And so Alien Covenant, like the ending of Prometheus, ends on this sort of cliffhanger, where Noomir Pace and David go off in their ship to go find the engineer's home planet, and that's where it ends. And then this movie takes place 10 years later, and it kind of like lets you pick up a lot of the pieces from what happened in between. I think there is an argument to be made that like the movie that happened in between these two movies is probably really good. And And I kind of wish we had seen at least a little bit of that, because there was a lot of this movie that was on the cutting room floor, I think. It's a movie that I basically like, I understood what was happening throughout the runtime. But there's a lot of supplemental features that came out with this. Like, there's a prologue and there's like all this stuff that went online. And there's like an extra scene with Noomir Pace as her character from Prometheus, and all this stuff that went online. And it's like, oh, this would have explained a lot of things in Alien Covenant.
I mean, it seems like that's like almost a franchise trait at this point. All the movies have a very, or not very long, but different, longer director's cuts. I think Aliens might not be that long. Different time difference? I don't remember.
Alien has like a minute shorter director's cut, actually.
Okay, yeah. That was the one I was thinking of.
Aliens, the director's cut of that adds a bunch of stuff dealing with Newt's family.
Right.
And then Alien 3, the director's cut, is superior to the original version. That's like the...
but I guess the point I'm making is that it seems like there's always a ton of stuff that the director wanted to do for these movies that...
Well, that's also a Ridley Scott thing. Like, he's somebody who releases movies in theaters and then almost immediately comes out with a director's cut afterwards. There are like 3 or 4 different versions of Blade Runner, right? And the final cut is the definitive version of that. Kingdom of Heaven, the director's cut, is like notably better than the actual movie. And you know, most of them don't need director's cuts. Like, he's a director that I think he basically has carte blanche to do whatever he wants in these movies. And you know, I don't see any kind of uncompromised vision happening here or something. Like, I don't think the studio is giving him notes on how to make his Alien movie or anything. But you know, he is somebody who values the pacing of his movie, and I think values the story more so than maybe like character development, or he sees certain details as extraneous and will cut them out of the movie if he feels he needs to in order to move the plot along. And that's to be said, like, this movie starts off fairly slowly, right? It's a kind of slow burn for the first like half hour or so, much akin to the original Alien. But even so, like, I feel like you lose a lot of parts. Like, I actually didn't realize this until it was pointed out to me afterwards. But in the trailer for this movie, it's mentioned that, you know, they're a ship that's all couples, right? That's the idea. It's a colonization mission. And I don't think they mention once in the actual movie itself that they are all couples.
No.
And that seems like a really important detail. And it's something you can basically gather. But it's it just seems like something you might have just wanted to throw out there at the beginning. Like, oh, yeah, this is the colonization mission that we're all couples and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, it definitely was one of the things that I remembered during the first 10, 15 minutes when, you know, we're still kind of in this weird slow burn spaceship drama thing, right? That's going on, much like the beginning of the first Alien, like you said. And I remembered that line, so like, the emotional punch of what happens in the first 3 or 4 minutes of the movie, or after the prologue, I guess, made a lot more sense. And like, you can kind of just gather that through context clues. But I was definitely like, oh yeah, I remember that they're all a couple. Like, everyone is couples, like the crew. even though they don't mention it. I mean, like, they eventually start mentioning like everyone mentions their wife or husband at some point.
Right.
But it's never explicitly said, which I guess, like you said, that, Ridley Scott felt that you would be able to, through context clues, figure that out. So cut that line out. We don't need it.
Yep.
Or cut that scene out or whatever.
Pretty much what happened, yeah. So I feel like we've been talking about it for a little while at this point. We should probably get into spoilers for Alien Covenant. Am I right?
Yeah. I think it's interesting that this is also, we're talking about how much there is to discuss and the full philosophical questions that this movie asks. It's like one of the longest times we've gone before we've gotten to spoilers.
That's true.
So let's do it.
Yeah, this is probably our longest non-Marvel podcast in quite a while. And in those ones, just like, oh, that was so cool. That was so neat. That was
the best.
But this is I really enjoyed Alien Covenant. I don't think it's a perfect movie. I think it is messy in spots, but I think it is a better movie than Prometheus. I think it is a really interesting one. To discuss. So let's move on into spoilers for Alien Covenant, starting right now.
Stop it! Both of you! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Alien Covenant, starting right now. So I just have a few things that I did want to talk about in this movie. The final twist, in which Walter turns out to actually be David, and then he places Waterston into hypersleep. I think it is so well played. I love that twist. I think it is a super obvious twist, like from the get go. Like, I knew that was going to happen, and that's something that I've saw people criticize about the movie. And I don't think that's a great criticism. I feel like Ridley Scott knows that you're going to know that that's happening, and I think that adds like this kind of tension to like the last few scenes in the movie where there's like, oh man, is he gonna betray them in some way or like what have you? Like, is he actually David? Is he actually Walter? Like, that you have that in your mind. And so I think that's a really well played twist, and it's so inevitable that I thought it really, really worked.
I mean, it's the, like the Hitchcock quote, like, if you show that there's a couple sitting at a table with a bomb beneath the table, it adds more tension if the audience knows what's going to happen.
Yes.
So I was in, like, it's pretty obvious. We don't see the conclusion of the, I think, is it Devendra or David Chen? I can't remember, on / Filmcast, caused the android kung fu fight. Which was awesome, but you don't see the conclusion of it, so it's pretty obvious. But I was into it. Yeah, I thought it was cool.
Speaking of that, man, I mean, Fassbender versus Fassbender, Dawn of Fassbenders was...
I'm in.
Yeah,
like you said, I'm down for the 6-movie David Covenant spinoffs.
I thought that was cool. I feel like we haven't really actually mentioned this yet, but Michael Fassbender plays a dual role in this movie as a
yeah I mean, I didn't know that. Is that in any of the trailers and stuff?
I don't think that was revealed in any of the trailers. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was another point for being unsullied.
Yeah. I mean, I think Walter was in the trailers. Like he was in the trailers.
I mean, I knew Michael Fassbender was in it, but I didn't know that it was both.
Yes. So, that was very cool. I think that was a very cool reveal that there was two Fassbenders running around. I figured David would make an appearance after he showed up in the prologue, but that was still very cool. And I really just enjoyed watching Fassbender play against himself. I think he does a fantastic job again in this movie. If there was any justice in the world, he would get an Oscar for Alien Covenant. I think it would be insane. I would have watched a whole movie of Michael Fassbender playing the flute with himself for and then making out with himself at one point.
Making out's a strong word. strong term for that.
Okay, fair enough.
But I do think that those scenes are really fucking cool. Just having no cuts as the camera slowly pans from David to Walter and back while they're having this discussion was just a pretty cool technical feat.
Absolutely. And the way like the contrast between those two characters and the way like Walter is not the evil menace that David is, but even David's not evil in the traditional sense. He just has no he has no understanding of morality, I guess. He has no he has no perception of what that even means.
He's too human, right? Like he's so human it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
As Walter says, he tells him that outright.
Yeah, so they almost like decrease the human dosage or whatever. I think
that Walter says that something along those lines, that they made him less quirky, less idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
Because that's part of what I feel like a lot of David's menace for the first half that he's in, I guess, so the first quarter or whatever, I don't know, whatever, however you want to break it down, comes from just knowing what happened in Prometheus, because he's helpful. He's saving them. He's doing all the cool shit.
Yeah.
And he's not being creepy or scary yet.
Except for that one part where he poisons the guy's drink, I think is the...
Right. Well, no. I mean, in Alien Covenant...
The first
part that he's in, he's not menacing, he's not creepy. In this movie, the context of Prometheus makes him scarier.
Right. Yeah,
I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, and that's the thing. Like in Prometheus, like he's like we're saying he's too human. Like in Prometheus, he's established as like enjoying art and like doing all these kind of things. There's a bit in the at the beginning of that movie which I love, where he's watching Lawrence of Arabia. He's like watching it, and then right after you see him watching it, he's like styling his hair after the main character in the movie, Peter O'Toole's character. And so I think that's I think there's a lot of really great character stuff with David. He's an incredible character, and I think the reveal in this movie that he murdered Noomir Pace as Shaw, which you were referring to before when I was talking about Alien 3.
James Franco was the first thing I thought of, but that happens on screen.
Okay, well, but James Franco was also not in Prometheus or anything. He wasn't a fan favorite character. That struck me as like, oh, it's a cameo of James Franco, and he dies. Like,
which is hilarious. I got to know what the director's cut of that is. Why is that James Franco?
I believe he's in the prologue of the movie, like the one that went online.
Oh, that makes sense.
So that might be it. And apparently Noomir Pace also shot a scene that went online too.
Now that I do remember that happening in Prometheus also for the promotional stuff, that them putting out the auditions, quote unquote, I think, of their characters interviewing to be on the ship of in Prometheus.
Okay, yeah, I remember that. I remember there was a promotional
Weird viral promotional stuff.
Yeah, there was a lot of viral stuff from Prometheus. I think this is actually legit, like actual scenes for that could have been in the movie that they decided not to be. But really odd stuff there. But the reveal that he did murder Shaw just shows like it's such an effective, like cold-blooded scene. It kind of shows the ruthlessness of David, even though he's not a ruthless guy. Like he's just he's David.
It's so interesting to see him, David, pursuing the most, like I think I said earlier, that like the most human drive to create, whether it be art or life in form of children, like whatever it might be, create. But he comes at it from the cold, heartless, emotionless, mechanical sense, where he doesn't get the impact of the things he's doing, just, you know, but the ends justify the means kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I did want to mention some of the great set pieces in this movie, because there are a few that I really, really enjoyed. Specifically, I think my favorite sequence in this movie is when Danny McBride picks up Catherine Waterston, Demian Bashir, and Fassbender up in that small ship, and the alien starts attacking.
Because
that was like like, that was a really great scene. The use of the crane in that scene is a total, like, oh, shit moment.
Yeah.
It is awesome. It's a really cool, effective action scene.
Yeah, I think also, like, a shout-out to just the Alien franchise as a whole with their badass female action heroes for the last 30 years.
That's true. Ripley and then New Mirror Face and now Catherine Waterston.
Yeah, I think Catherine Waterston gets a little less to do. I don't remember Noomi Rapace as an action hero specifically, but that Prometheus isn't very much of an action movie, right? But she's still the protagonist of that movie. But I feel like Catherine Waterston is definitely Daniels is definitely set up to be like a new Ripley kind of thing, like in terms of she's fairly capable, much more capable than everyone else on the crew, at least.
I could see that. If these movies weren't specifically about David and... We're instead about the human characters. I could see her popping up in the next movie. I think it will be another thing where it's going to be like 10 years in the future, and like it's going to be about David doing some other crazy shit. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
If there's another one, I don't think this movie did that well, and I don't think Prometheus did that well either. And this movie happened anyway. So,
yeah, I think it's just Ridley Scott going to do what Ridley Scott going to do.
I guess. So that was a great set piece. And also the set piece right after that, when the alien bursts out of Demi and Bashir and Catherine Waterston and Danny McBride have to eject it with Fassbender's help. And that's the sequence where it's like, you don't know if that's David or Walter. Because like that fight has already happened between the two Fassbenders. And so you like, is he going to like betray them? Is he going to like send them down the wrong hallway or something? Cause they're like entirely dependent on what he's doing in that scene. And I think that was really cool. And then they end up, you know, throwing the alien at the airlock, and it's awesome, and it's pretty neat.
It's also straight out of Alien and Aliens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
They've pulled the airlock thing a few times in this range.
Yeah. They love shooting shit out into space.
Absolutely. But yeah, the thing that this movie does kind of fall flat on is a lot of the character work, which, again, I liked Catherine Waterston and Danny McBride quite a bit, and Fassbender is aces. But then there was, like, that final set piece with Demi and Bashir. I was surprised that Demi and Bashir was in that final set piece. Because I didn't realize he was still alive. Like, I thought the character had died. I was surprised he made it as long as he... Because his inclusion at the end is like, if he's going to be at the end of this movie, he should have had more things to do throughout the movie. So I kind of care about him a little bit. And then there's a lot of, like, other characters who just, like, do... Like, it's kind of the same complaint that people have with Prometheus. Like, these characters do stupid things all the time. You know, that in turn causes them to die at the hands of the alien, and that isn't great. But the alien, like the alien attacks, are cool. There's like the one sequence where they're in the med bay, and the one scientist, I think it's Danny McBride's wife, I think it's Amy Simetz,
on the rover, on the planet, or in the ship,
On the planet in the med bay, right? When the alien comes, or the two people come in, and the alien bursts out of one of the guys, and she starts freaking out, and Lee runs away from the med bay and locks the other person in the, the door, and then she runs back with like an axe or something, and then like they all die, and it's like, this is weird. Like, what? I mean, I enjoyed the sequence. I thought it was a lot of fun to watch, but like it was a lot of like substitute. Like, they're supposed to be relatively smart characters, right? These are, like, scientists and, like, people. I mean, I know they're colonists this time around, so maybe it's not as smart as they should have been in Prometheus. But at the same time...
Yeah.
At the same time, there's, like, basic common sense kind of things that... I was, like,
It makes sense. I felt that one... That character locking the other people in the med bay seemed like a rational... I mean, rational is not the right word. A logical choice in an irrational situation, right? Like, there's some weird shit. Quarantine them in the med bay. I need to fucking get the shotgun or whatever she goes for. I bought that. There's definitely, you know, Billy Crudup looking in the egg, like putting his face in the egg.
That was almost as bad as the guy in Prometheus, like, poking the thing with his finger. Like that.
Yeah, which they do again in this one when there's that weird fucking pustule thing on the ground.
Yeah.
But I think that sequence, that whole... from the moment they start to investigate the ship on the planet to when the rover fucking explodes was really intense. The people running from a bad situation to a worse situation that they don't know about was really intense. I like that stuff. That part where that was probably my favorite set piece action wise.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff in Alien Covenant. I gotta say, I feel like. we've talked about this a long time at this point, so we should probably try to wrap it up. But do you have any final thoughts about Alien Covenant, Mike?
I think, like I said before, it's a really cool, it has really cool action horror stuff. We have a nice throwback, a nice return to that for a while. And then we get some really deep, philosophical, interesting meditations on creation and art and what it means to be sentient in some weird way, right? The desire to make things. And even if it doesn't get to an answer, which I don't really know if you could with that kind of question, I applaud its effort for going there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I really enjoyed Alien Covenant. I think it's a little bit better than Prometheus. You know, it doesn't reach the heights of the Alien franchise, but it takes it to a lot of really interesting places that I really enjoy talking about. So that is our review of Alien Covenant. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, I do some work on crookedscoreboard.com. You can check me out there. Thanks so much for listening to Filmbookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks for the next Film Bookcast, where we'll probably be reviewing Wonder Woman. Pretty excited about that one, Mike. I've heard good things, which is cool. The DC slump may finally be over.
Yeah. Wonder Woman gonna put the team on her back and just save the day.
Yeah, hopefully. And then you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're gonna be talking Nicolas Cage's directorial debut, 2002's Sonny, which we've been advertising for quite a long time at this point. But this time it'll actually happen. We hope.
In theory.
2002's Sonny, which stars Alien Covenant star James Franco.
strong word.
Alien Covenant featured player James Franco.
There you go.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.
Send me a kiss by wire. Baby, my heart's on fire. If you refuse me, honey, you lose me. Then you'll be left alone. Oh, baby, telephone and tell me I'm your own.
Check, please.